Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I think people like us are interested in true crime cases and dark stories for several reasons. Besides the fact that they're just interesting, I think there are people who like puzzles and mysteries. I think there are people who like reality better than fiction. And I think there are people like me who are fascinated with the conversation of why people do what they do. What makes someone a killer? Why do some people commit the ultimate crime, something that most of us would never dream of doing? I think somewhere in my brain, I believe that if I can learn everything there is to know about people who kill, which is impossible, I will somehow be able to avoid becoming a victim, or maybe I'll be able to make peace with the violence that I see every day. I consciously know that's never going to happen, but those thoughts must live somewhere in my mind, deep down. I get comfort from trying to figure out why people do bad things. And when there is no answer to why, it's very, very unsettling for me. And I know many of you feel the same as I do. This case was suggested by my viewer, Damon Thor. So thank you, Damon, for bringing this case to my attention. This was a tough one. All of the surface articles state the exact same thing, and they're no more than three paragraphs. This crime doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. But I dove deeper and was able to find more details on this terrible crime. Most murder is motivated by money, sex, or rage. Most. What happens when there is absolutely no motivation for murder whatsoever? What happens when people kill just to kill? And even more terrifying, they plan it all out. This is the story of the Seaside Thrill Killings. Let's get into it. June 1997. Our story begins in the beautiful town of Seaside, Oregon. Seaside is a small place. There are only about 7,500 people that live there. It's a tourist destination, people going there to visit and see the long, expansive beaches and beautiful sunrises and sunsets. There's a famous place there called the Seaside Promenade. Lots of locals call it the Prom. It's 1.5 miles of boardwalk, and people love to jog and cycle along the path. It used to be wooden, but has been modernized with concrete. There are restaurants and bars and even an aquarium. The area has a lot of very famous Lewis and Clark history tied to it, and history buffs love to visit the area for that reason. Tillamook Head is a beautiful natural rock formation that Lewis and Clark were so impressed by, Clark wrote, "I behold the grandest and most pleasing prospect which my eyes ever surveyed." There is also the iconic Tillamook Rock Lighthouse that looks like something out of a movie. There are galleries and museums and lots of beautiful wildlife to enjoy, making Seaside a popular place for nature photographers. You can kayak, you can windsurf, bike, ride scooters. It's just a very peaceful place, a serene place to spend some time with the ocean and with nature. And that makes what happened all the more disturbing. This is Jesse McAllister. Police have described him as a violent, kind of gang-banging wannabe kid who wasn't afraid of anything and who had no concept of social grace or fear of being caught or punished. Jesse's stepmother describes him as a mean little daddy's boy. He was always getting into trouble, and he had kind of an inane hatred for everyone around him. He thought he was better than most people, smarter, more important. So it sounds like we might be dealing with a narcissist. People remember Jesse as someone who had absolutely no empathy for others. He made fun of people. He bullied people. He embarrassed people. And as a result, his peers, kids at his school and in his area, were afraid of him. Now, Jesse's mother has a different story. She says he was a nice boy who never got into a fight. It's very interesting to have such different views, one from his stepmother and one from his mother. Of course, there can be bias coming from both of those places, but usually when people describe someone, they're not that far apart like they are with Jesse. We have two very different versions of Jesse, depending on who you ask. When Jesse was older, he wanted to get into criminal life and even told people that he was going to become a hitman. He wanted to make a lot of money doing something illegal, and he wasn't shy talking about it. Jesse was living in an apartment complex, and so was this young man, Bradley Price. Police have described Bradley as a follower. He had been a star athlete at Brookings High School and had done quite well in school. He went off to the University of Oregon, but he only lasted there a year before dropping out. Even before dropping out, Bradley's life was on a downward spiral. His grades had slipped, he wasn't enjoying the college experience, and he seemed different to those around him. After leaving college, Bradley moved up to the North Coast. He got a job at a local video store where he was working mostly nights, and he spent his days sitting around drinking Robitussin to get high. Bradley loved movies, and he watched In Cold Blood over and over. What a great film that is. I myself have watched that a lot. Jesse and Bradley become acquainted because they live in the same complex, and Jesse starts talking himself up to Bradley. I get the impression from everything I read about Jesse that he's kind of one of those people who lives in a fantasy world. You know those people, right? They don't seem to be connected with their actual reality. They spend a lot of time in their heads. That's not always a bad thing, but it is when the thoughts in those heads are violent, and Jesse's definitely were. Jesse and Bradley begin talking about killing people. Jesse says he thinks killing people for money would be the easiest way in the world to make a very good living. And it becomes apparent to Bradley that Jesse has thought a lot about this. But before too long, the fantasy talk turned all too real, and Jesse and Bradley began making plans to actually kill someone. They didn't care who, and they didn't care why. They didn't care about stealing from them. They wanted to kill simply to know what it felt like, simply to say they had done it. For a couple of weeks in June of 1997, Jesse and Bradley talked about how they were going to go about making their desires a reality. And to me, that is what makes this particular crime so insidious. We know of cases where people, let's say maybe they go out drinking with their friends, or they start driving around in a car, things escalate, somebody pulls out a gun, and then sadly someone is shot. You've got maybe a group of really immature people doing stupid and dangerous things. Well, that is not the case here. Jesse and Bradley were pretty methodical in their planning. They knew they wanted to kill on the beach because they felt they could pick a spot that would allow them kind of an easy getaway with not a lot of people around, if anyone at all. They knew they wanted it to be totally random, and they knew they would use a gun. Then the planning phase turned into the hunting phase. Jesse and Bradley would get into Jesse's car and cruise up and down the area near the beach, sometimes all day and into the night. In watching the few interviews I did find, I kind of got the impression that they were working up the courage to do what they wanted to do, while kind of eyeing the area, watching the comings and goings of the locations, which ones had police that might drive by, which ones had a lot of people, which ones were less occupied. Ooh, I just pictured that in my mind as I was saying that. You're sitting on the beach. I love to go to the beach. And I just had this flash of an image with my family on the beach and having, you know, these two evil monsters slowly drive by in their car watching us. That's really scary. This reminds me of Israel Keyes, the serial killer. I covered him a while ago. He would plant these kill kits in random locations. I mean, he knew where they were at. And it didn't matter whoever walked by when he went to one of these kits to use it. It was just whoever happened to walk by at the moment, he would kill him. There's something really terrifying in that randomness, isn't there? Whenever I watch a true crime story, this sounds bad. I'm always relieved to know it was the husband or the uncle or the father-in-law. You know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, it makes you feel like it's not so random. I think the randomness is particularly scary. It's horrifying to think about just how random our life is and how easily you can become a victim to someone like Jesse and Bradley. And like I said, I think somewhere in my OCD brain, I feel like if I can learn enough about it, I can prevent it. Well, I can't. You just never know what someone has planned for you. And you never have the foresight not to be in the place they're targeting when they decide to strike. That's our reality. Jesse and Bradley were hunting. They were hunting for humans. They were hunting for someone to kill. One night, as they were cruising along the beach area, they got out of their car and walked down to the water's edge. There was a group of girls having a bonfire on the beach. So Jesse and Bradley approached them to talk to them, which again is terrifying. These two guys look like every other young man did in 1997. They really do. How on earth would you ever know that they're looking to do something so terrible? There are no outward signs here. One of the girls at this bonfire later said that as the two guys stood and talked with the girls around the bonfire, Jesse was kind of taunting Bradley, trying to make him look bad in front of the girls. And she said it was awkward, especially because Bradley didn't really try and defend himself. So again, it just sounds like Jesse was being a bully. But then Jesse said to Bradley, "You're not going to go through with it." And Bradley said, "Yes, I am." The girls later said that they remember thinking, "What are they talking about?" It almost sounds like Jesse wanted to talk about their plans in front of the girls to make himself look cool or something. I don't know. He sounds really out of it, really far removed from reality. When you look at some of these photos, Jesse looks like a little weaselly guy. I mean, he looks like he's 13 years old right here. But then in other photos, he looks a lot larger. Bradley was more athletic looking and kind of a softer person than Jesse. And I even read that he wrote poetry and he absolutely loved movies. That's part of the reason he got a job at the video store. So after the duo spoke with the girls at the bonfire, they went back to their car parked near the promenade, and then they headed downtown. It was close to closing time for the local bars, which is 2:30 a.m. in Oregon. So this would have been around 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. So now we've got Jesse and Bradley cruising around downtown. The bars are letting out, and two people who had been enjoying their evening in one of these local bars left the bar, never knowing that it would be their last night on Earth. July 14th, 1997. 36-year-old Frank Casey Nims and 26-year-old Gabriella Brooke Goza were together having some drinks in a bar. Frank was a commercial fisherman and landscaper. He had an 11-year-old daughter from a previous relationship, and Brooke was an artist. She was also the daughter of a prominent local family and the mother of a young child. The two were in a romantic relationship, and after they left the bar, they walked down near the sand dunes on the beach near Seaside. They were there for quite some time and had decided to stay until the sun came up so they could watch the sunset together. They were just enjoying each other's company, enjoying the sound of the waves on a beautiful summer night, and hoping for a spectacular sunrise to share together. Instead, Jesse McAllister and Bradley Price, who had spotted them sitting alone, walked up to the couple from behind. They then walked around the couple to face them, and without saying a word, Jesse McAllister raised his gun, a 9mm calico, and shot Brooke in the face. Then his gun jammed. Jesse began to wrestle with the slide on the gun. Frank had time to perhaps make a run for it, but instead, he turned all of his attention to Brooke, trying to hold her head up and find any sign of life in her. Jesse unjammed his gun, raised it again, and shot Frank in the head. Both Frank and Brooke were dead. This poor couple, just sitting on the beach on a summer night, were murdered, executed really, just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. As the bodies of Frank and Brooke lay on the beach, the sun did start to rise, but they never saw it. Jesse and Bradley left the beach, got into Jesse's car, and grabbed their bags. Just like in their favorite movie, In Cold Blood, which they had rented four times in June to watch over and over, they were headed to Mexico. As the sun came up and the local beach walkers and joggers headed to the seashore for their morning exercise, the bodies were immediately discovered. Word spread through town like wildfire. People were shocked. This was a very small, peaceful town with local families going back generations, running shops and restaurants for the tourists. This was not a place where murders happened, and it was definitely not a place where double murders happened. The police were called, and they immediately cordoned off the beach and began their investigation. Residents living nearby were questioned, and police were surprised to hear that they hadn't heard a thing. No one reported hearing gunshots, and no one knew what time the murders occurred. There were, however, some people who had seen two men walking away from the beach, and as police put the timelines together using a nearby Skycam mounted on top of a restaurant, they thought they knew who their suspects were. There was a camera on one of the local restaurants nearby, and it only took pictures every couple of seconds. So they didn't have like a moving image, and it was in black and white. It was a little bit rough, but they thought they were these two men that were kind of known petty criminals in the area. So they find these two men, they're rounded up, and they spend about 24 hours talking with the police. But at the end of the interviews, police knew they had the wrong suspects. So it was about 24 hours off and on talking with these two guys, and then 12 more hours to kind of come to the conclusion that it wasn't them. By this time, there were people in the town that had seen the images that the police had seen, the two men coming from the beach. And a couple of people started to say, that looks like Jesse and Bradley, those two guys that are always cruising around in Jesse's car. The police didn't know about them. They didn't have criminal records. But there were people in town in Seaside that said, I think that's Jesse and Bradley. Police go to their apartment and nobody answers the door. And I think at this point they ask for a warrant and get one. Again, I'm kind of piecing this together because there is not a lot of information on this case. The police get inside of the apartments and they find that they're cleaned out. The clothing is gone. Electronics are gone. There's one TV missing. They can see that there's dust where it had recently been taken. So now they've got people saying that they think it was Jesse and Bradley walking away from the beach. Their apartments are cleaned out and Jesse's car is gone. At this point, they were pretty sure they knew who committed these murders. Only a day and a half had passed, but it was enough time. Jesse and Bradley had driven down the coast and crossed the border into Mexico and disappeared. For the next year, police would search for the two men. They had no idea where they were or where they had run to. They had no leads and realized that after 36 hours, the men could be almost anywhere. They had no idea they were headed to Mexico. In fact, I read some articles that said one of the mothers came forward and said she thought her son was headed to Idaho. His father lived there, something like that. Police didn't know if they had driven or flown or got on a cruise ship. This was pre-9/11, and it was much tougher to track people in airports and on planes than it is now. And to top that off, you know, they thought they could have fake IDs. Because Brooke was from a prominent family, there were theories that went around that she had been murdered. You know, maybe they were going to try to kidnap her, hold her for ransom, demand money from her family, but it went wrong and she was killed. They didn't know, it was just random. It could have been anybody. Weeks went by and then months, and it began to look like there would never be any justice for Frank and Brooke. July 20th, 1998. 1 year after the double murder, Border Patrol agents stop a young man trying to get into Texas from Mexico. Two U.S. Customs agents at the Brownsville, Texas station thought the young man trying to cross the border was acting nervous, and they decided to run his photo through their database. At first, they weren't sure if this was just someone acting strange, but when they saw the photos, they knew. This young man was Jesse McAllister, and he was wanted in Oregon for a double murder. Jesse was immediately taken into custody. Authorities didn't know how many times he had tried or had crossed the border successfully. He could have been going back and forth for the entire year that he'd been missing, but they just didn't know. Thankfully, these two U.S. Customs agents were alert and aware, and, you know, they followed their instincts. They thought he was acting strange. He was probably really nervous. So Jesse was taken into custody and ordered to stand before a judge. He stood in a white jail jumpsuit, shackled for his arraignment. He was given a public defender, and then he started talking to the police. Where was Bradley Price? Well, Jesse McAllister gave police a pretty good idea. Bradley had been working as a bartender and a stripper in a nightclub in Mexico. Jesse told police he thought Bradley would still be there. And before Bradley could take the stage and start performing at the strip club, the police stormed the nightclub in Mexico and took him into custody about 5 days after Jesse was arrested. It kind of surprised me to learn that Jesse turned Bradley in the beginning. And then I thought about it and I was like, no, he's just one of those people. He's a snake. The second he got caught, he didn't want anybody else to get away with what he wasn't going to get away with. You know, that's the narcissism. So the Mexican authorities held Bradley in one of their jails and they began to negotiate with the U.S. for his extradition. After authorities in the U.S. agreed not to seek the death penalty against Bradley, the Mexican authorities agreed to release him. Bradley's mother came forward and said there was no way her son was capable of violence. She said that he hadn't even been able to shoot a deer on the deer hunt. You know, I'm sure it is really hard for moms to learn that their sons are capable of something like this. Their daughters are capable of terrible things. I don't have any doubt in the world that it's hard for them to come to grips with that or why they say those things. Jesse was moved to the Polk County Jail in Dallas to await extradition. Bradley was taken to the Tillamook County Jail in Tillamook, Oregon. The police did not want the men anywhere near each other because they didn't want them talking, trying to get their story straight, and they didn't want the men to know how the other man was arrested or whether or not he was speaking with the police, giving them details. Bradley immediately began proclaiming his innocence. He stated that Jesse had pulled the trigger. He told the cops that yes, Jesse had been talking about wanting to murder someone for a long time, but that he never thought he would actually do it. He thought it was all talk because Jesse was such a braggart. Bradley claimed that the night of the murders, he had actually tried to talk Jesse out of killing the couple, but Jesse wouldn't listen to him. Well, as we know, it doesn't matter if you pull the trigger or not. If you're involved in a murder, you're guilty of murder. Bradley didn't seem to understand that, but he soon would. Then death threats started coming in. Jesse had been moved to a separate Oregon jail, separate from Bradley, and both jails were receiving death threats directed at Jesse and Bradley from people in the Seaside area and even around the country. Then Jesse and Bradley started getting death threats from other prisoners. People wanted them dead for this cowardly and disgusting act. The police and jailers did their best to keep the prisoners safe while the trial proceeded. In August of 1998, a trial date for May of 1999 was set. Bradley's court-appointed lawyer asked for a change of venue, but it was denied. Jesse McAllister went to trial first. A deal was struck with prosecutors, and in February of 1999, Jesse McAllister stood before a court and admitted that he had murdered Frank and Brooke that day in July of 1997. In return for his confession, Jesse was given 2 consecutive life terms with no possibility for parole. He was let off to prison to begin his sentence that would last for the rest of his life. Bradley Price's trial proceeded as scheduled in May of 1999 as well. He asked to have a judge hear his case and sentence him rather than a jury. In the end, the judge rejected Bradley's attorney's claims that he was an innocent bystander. Circuit Judge Philip Nielsen said, "He was more than just passive. He was an active participant. I'm convinced he aided and abetted." It also came out at trial that Bradley had purchased the gun that was used in the murder. So his claims of not believing Jesse was serious were pretty much moot at that point. Bradley was convicted of 2 counts of aggravated murder and sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms with the possibility of parole after 30 years. I found him very easily with an inmate search. Bradley is now 47 years old and sits in prison at the Snake River Correctional Institute in Ontario, Oregon. He will first be eligible for parole in 2029. Jesse? Well, Jesse is a whole different story. Jesse McAllister files for clemency with the governor of Oregon. The public immediately expressed outrage at the thought of this heartless killer receiving clemency, and people began writing letters and petitions to stop it from even being considered. People were angry, and they did not want him out.
It's been 23 years since convicted killer Jesse McAllister was shot and killed a couple on Seaside Beach. Those murders were dubbed as the Seaside Thrill Killings. Now tonight, one of the victim's daughters is speaking out after McAllister filed for clemency from Governor Kate Brown. Fox 12's Drew Marine reports.
She says it's painful to hear McAllister has asked for this. While it's been 23 years, she says that's not long enough for taking 2 lives.
But it's definitely something I don't think you ever 100% get over. There was just a lot of chaos that day, a lot of confusion in the beginning hours of exactly what had happened and who the victims were. And they had just hit it off and were enjoying just a peaceful time, sitting out, watching the sunrise on the beach.
And what happened next was grisly. Gunmen 20-year-old Jesse McAllister and Bradley Price were in Seaside when McAllister told Price he wanted to kill someone just to see what it felt like.
He proceeded to shoot and kill Gabriella in front of my father. And he actually explicitly wrote that my father at that point in time did have the opportunity to run and leave the situation. His gun had jammed. And while he was clearing the jam, my father was trying to help Gabriella. And then he was able to get his gun cleared and he shot my father. When I got that call, a whole lot of emotions rushed to the surface. I was in shock, fear, just despair. I hope that Governor Brown would definitely look hard into the nature of this type of a crime and make her decision based off of, you know, the effects that it's had on so many people. I felt just very hurt that this would be something that would even be considered.
The governor's office released a statement of reply that reads in part, quote, "The governor understands that families may have concerns when someone is being considered for clemency, which is why she takes the review process very seriously. Victims always have an opportunity to be heard through the trauma-informed outreach facilitated by the district attorney's office. The governor does not consider clemency without considering input from the victim through the DA. I looked for the actual pleadings, but I didn't find anything that stated any type of decision has been made on this matter. Clemency is a very long and complicated process. And frankly, I wouldn't hold my breath if I were Jesse McAllister. If he gets what he deserves, he will die alone, in prison, and will leave only in a box. I hope the family members of the victims are doing their best to move through this tragic event, and I'm confident in saying I believe my community believes both men are right where they belong." Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit that like button for me if you like the video. It helps. You can subscribe to my channel if you'd like to see more from me. And you can also join my Patreon. There will be some bonus content there. And for a couple bucks a month, you can help us raise money for cold case DNA storage testing. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Brighten up your garage or workspaces with LED utility and panel light bulbs from GT Light. GT Light light bulbs are energy efficient, and with their easy adjustable light panels, you can direct light where you need it most. Save big on all GT industrial utility and panel light bulbs. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for more hot deals happening now. Save big.